everybody for participating with us again. We held our last call 6 days ago on October the 3rd, and as we promised during the period of the shutdown, we will continue to hold these calls periodically to give each of the media in our district an update as to what is occurring in Washington. I will tell you, a lot of the things you read in more of the national media are not necessarily always correct. And so if you've heard something that you'd like to ask me about when we go to the Q&A session, please be sure to do that. Since we last visited, the House has passed 8 more of the many appropriations bills that we discussed last time. These have to do with FEMA, with the WIC program, with the federal employees to pay those that are currently working so that they'll have retroactive pay whenever the shutdown ends. We funded the Food and Drug Administration. We funded Head Start. We also passed a I'll keep talking about what we funded. We passed a second bill to ensure that federal employees will be paid on the 15th of this month for those that are currently working. We've also passed that benefits for fallen soldiers will be paid. Some of you may have read a few press accounts this weekend where we lost 5 military men and women in action in Afghanistan this weekend, and the Department of Defense, for some reason, decided not to pay them the typical death benefits that the military has received in the past. So we passed a bill today to deal with that. We also passed funding today to fund the FAA. Altogether, if you take all 14 of these, what I call, again, mini appropriations bills, we have appropriated somewhere in the neighborhood of about 40% of the total amount that was included in the original continuing resolution that the House passed 4 times and that the Senate rejected 4 times. So we're continuing to do our work on these things to move forward. We also passed a bill yesterday, which was another attempt to try to get the Senate to sit down with us in some sort of a conference or negotiating session so that we can begin to deal not only with the continuing resolution and with the issues surrounding the Affordable Care Act, but also to address the issues that are coming up pretty quickly, and that being the primary issue being the debt ceiling, which we have been told we are going to hit next Tuesday on the 17th. That bill proposed that we have a committee of 20 members that's bipartisan and bicameral, 10 from the House that would include 6 Republicans and 4 Democrats, 10 from the Senate that would include 4 Republicans and 6 Democrats. So we've proposed that, again, trying to show that our goal remains, that our stance is we need to sit down and negotiate this to try to get the government reopened and then to try to deal with the nation's pressing fiscal issues, particularly the debt ceiling that's coming up. Looking forward, the president has invited Congress to come to the White House in 4 separate groups. House and Senate Democrats will meet as 2 individual groups. We will have a group of Republican House members that will go over tomorrow, and then Senate Republicans will go over as well. I don't know what the outcome of those will be. I'm hopeful that we can tone down the rhetoric and the animus that has been exhibited by the president toward the leadership in the House and toward the House in general, if you will, and that we can begin to move forward to deal with the issues that are currently on most Americans' minds today. But notwithstanding what happens in those meetings, which I'm not sure what will happen, the House is going to continue to work on a few things. One is, it seems to us that it is time to begin merging additional items into the fiscal discussion. Up until now, it's been all related to the continuing resolution and to trying to do something to deal with Obamacare. What we're going to need to do, given the pressing debt ceiling that's coming up, as we need to put the debt ceiling on the table, and in connection with the debt ceiling conversation, we need to include all the things that are components that are causing us to continue to bump up to debt ceilings and then to have to raise debt ceilings and incur additional indebtedness. And those things include the big drivers of our debt, which include entitlements. We need to have tax reform so that we can take care of the revenue side of the equation through economic growth. We also need to look at policy reforms. One of the things that our businesses are telling us, not only in Texas District 17, but across the country, is that the regulatory regime is really starting to hurt their ability to conduct business in the country. So they'd like to, we need to put in some policy reforms there, similar to the RAINS Act that we passed in each of the last two Congresses. The question that's on everybody's mind is the president willing to negotiate? I don't know. I think he left himself a little bit of an opening when Gene Sperling was talking on one of the Sunday shows to say that the president might accept a short-term debt ceiling increase. You know, we'll have to see. You know, there's interesting the way things work up here in Washington, the way people signal that they're willing to do or not do certain things. But I'm hoping that that is something that that he's willing to do, is to begin the negotiating process. And as I said, we're continuing to work on options. I think you've seen some press releases and op-eds today by Paul Ryan in the Wall Street Journal, where he has put forth a couple of solutions, a couple of options, so that we can work our way through this stalemate to move forward. While we're talking about debt ceilings, I think it's important to look at history for a minute. One of the things the president has said is that he will not negotiate on the debt ceiling if he is being extorted. I certainly wish that that type of language wasn't being used. If you look at the time period from 1978 to 2013, the debt ceiling has been raised 53 times. It was raised from just less than $1 trillion to over to the debt ceiling that we have today of over $16 trillion. If you look at those 53 times it was raised, 29 of those times the Congress was run by Democrats. 17 times we had a split Congress, and 7 of those were in a Republican-controlled Congress. And of those 53 increases, 26 were clean debt increases. In other words, that no other item was part of the debt ceiling increase. Congress just voted to raise the debt ceiling with no conditions whatsoever on that debt ceiling increase. So just under half. On the other hand, 27 times, or just over half, it was a conditional debt ceiling increase. So in addition to, in exchange for giving the president the debt ceiling increase that they wanted, there were certain additional provisions that were attached to those. And those run the gamut. It happened to Ronald Reagan 2 times, to George H.W. Bush, 41 time, to Bill Clinton 3 times, to George Bush, George W. Bush, 43. It happened 2 times. And so far to President Obama, it has happened 3 times. So just for frame of reference, just please know that it is not extortion for Congress to expect that certain things will be attached to debt ceiling increases whenever the president comes to Congress and Congress exercises its constitutional prerogative to agree to raise or not raise the debt ceiling, that Congress is perfectly within its rights and I'm sorry for the buzzer in the background, but Congress is perfectly within its constitutional rights to add conditions or provisions to those debt ceiling increases. So that's really the lay of the land at this point in time. With that, I'd like to ask Julie to open the lines up, and I think she'll tell you to press *1 to get in the queue for to ask a question.
Yes, thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please press *1, and you will be prompted to record your first and last name. Please unmute your phone when recording your name, and to withdraw your question, press *2. One moment, please. Our first question comes from Jordan Overturf. Your line is open.
All right, Congressman, last week, one of the questions that remained unanswered is how many people in the district are actually being affected by the shutdown?
And Jordan, I appreciate you asking that question and reminding us about that. We have still had inquiries out to try to get the answer, and unfortunately, I still don't have an answer. The people that track that have been deemed to be non-essential and furloughed, so it's hard. We have a second source looking, but they are inundated and working on a skeleton staff. So my goal is to give you an answer on this before the end of the shutdown, for sure.
Well, do you at least have a count of the number of active organizations or groups? Even if you don't have the exact number of people, do you have the number of organizations like Head Start, WIC, and things like that that are being affected?
Jordan, we haven't asked that question, but we will do that. And Andre is here writing these questions down, and we'll try to, I think we probably can answer that one next time.
Okay. And follow-up to that is, how is this shutdown affecting the flow of grant money to research institutions like Texas A&M?
At this point in time, we have not heard of any slowdown of grant money to research institutions. And as you know, Texas 17 has a footprint in three areas. We've got A&M, and we've got part of the UT system in our district, and we also have Baylor. We have not heard anything from any institution about any slowdowns, nor have we been advised by any federal agency that they're holding back research grants. I just noticed yesterday on one of A&M's news releases that one of their scientists, one of their PIs, just got a large grant. So far the grants are still flowing. But that said, they will be impacted. My goal is to get this shutdown closed, is to do my part to get this shutdown resolved before it does impact any of our three research institutions.
Thank you.
Thanks, George.
Once again, to ask a question, please press star one. One moment.
After the tone, please state your name.
Bill Oliver.
Thank you.
Ben Flores, how are you?
I'm doing great, Bruce. How about you?
I'm good, thank you. It came out earlier today, the Veterans Affairs, Mr. Shinseki, talked about the shutdown, and someone, VA official, said that 3.8 million veterans won't be getting their disability and checks and compensation if this goes on for a couple more weeks. Can you comment on that?
Actually, Bruce, the number is going to be 5.18 million veterans that will not be receiving their compensation, their checks on November the 1st, and the amount is about $6.5 billion. We had a hearing this morning with Secretary Shinseki to ask him about this. I can see why the VA is in that situation. Our goal, again, is to get it shut down before it impacts our veterans. One of the things that did surprise us is that based on our conversations with the VA in late September, we were advised that if there was a shutdown, and these conversations occurred on the 28th and the 30th of September, if there was a shutdown, that they would be able to have relatively normal operations all the way through to the end of October. And then they did say that the November 1st disability checks could be imperiled. Unfortunately, yesterday, we were surprised when several of the regional offices, including the regional office in Waco, issued furlough notices for substantial numbers of employees. Yesterday, the Waco regional office furloughed about 300 of 800 employees. Now, about 150 of those work in the office there in Waco. The other 150 are scattered around the state at Fort Bliss, Fort Hood, and out in El Paso. I specifically asked the Secretary Shinseki this morning of why that that came out and whether or not there was any political influence that caused it. He answered the question no, that there was no political influence. We haven't gotten a good answer as to why the shutdown or the scale back of their operations occurred much more quickly than they had told us just a week earlier. But we are going to continue to look into this particular issue. Again, if we get the government to reopen, we wouldn't have to worry about this. I will tell you, there are two bills out there. They're sitting in the Senate that, and either of them, if they were passed, would address the VA overnight. The first one is the Milcon VA bill, which we passed about 4 months ago in the House, which is the full appropriations bill done through what we call regular order, which would fully fund the VA for all of fiscal 2014, is languishing around in the Senate. And then last week, I believe it was on the 3rd, we passed, let me look it up, H.J. Res. I believe it was on September 3rd. Let me find it. H.J. Res. 72, which would fund the VA. That is over in the Senate as well. Either of these bills, if we could get the Senate to pass it, get the President to sign them, would cure this particular issue with respect to the VA, and it would do it fairly quickly. So, again, we've got a solution out there. I'm just hoping that somebody will capitalize on that solution and move forward. Bruce, anything else?
Thank you. No, that's it.
Thanks, Bruce.
Our next question comes from Bill Oliver. Your line is open.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Hello there. Glad you're sounding better.
Well, thank you. I was pretty sick last week.
Follow-up to your interview with Scott this morning talking about the number of Republicans in the House that would vote for a clean resolution. A lot of time between now and when the debt ceiling deadline hits, but do you think that number is going to change at all the closer that you get to the deadline?
Bill, that's a hypothetical question I'd have a hard time answering. I will tell you that there hasn't been much movement in terms of the Republican caucus in the House. We have all pretty well held firmly to our positions that we need to address some of the larger issues as part of any continuing resolution or as a debt ceiling or part of a debt ceiling deal. Now, to repeat for the rest of the audience, the rest of the folks on this call, what I was asked is whether or not the House would pass a clean CR if it were put onto the floor. That there has been a lot of the national media and particularly the Washington media that has said that it would pass based on some nose counting they had done that assumed that virtually every Democrat would vote for a clean CR and that somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 Republicans would vote for one. The way I've talked to some of these people whose names were listed, and they told me that the questions that they were presented were conditional. It said reporter A would go up to Congressperson B and say, Congressperson, if this and this happened, would you vote for a clean CR? And the Congressperson B would say, yes, I would do that. Well, they were checked as a yes box for a clean CR, but then when they published the name, they didn't publish it with the conditions under which that congressperson said that they would vote for it. So my guess is today you've got 200 Democrats and you've got 232 Republicans in the House. We have three openings in the House today. That you wouldn't get every Democrat, but most all of the 200 would vote for one, and you'd probably get five or six Republicans that would vote for a clean CR. That leaves you short of the 217 that are currently required today to pass a clean CR. So now people, including the President, have encouraged Speaker Boehner to put it on the floor and to have that vote. Here is the downside to doing that. If you put a clean CR on the floor and it fails because it doesn't have votes, and I don't think that it does, then you suddenly inject another level of uncertainty into the American economy because people would think that this thing is going to be more protracted than it is. So I think the better solution is to go the direction we have been, and that's to continue passing these mini appropriations bills. And I will tell you, at one time or another, 25% of the Democratic caucus has voted for one or more or all of these mini CR. I mean, the ones that passed today had 23 and 22 Democrats, respectively. The ones that passed, they had more than that. They had 197, which is the military payments bill. That was the unanimous bill, and 23 for the FAA funding. So putting a clean CR on the floor today, I think, has more downside than upside, and I really don't think that it would pass based on the real world on the House floor, not the world as some people would like to spin it.
Thank you.
Yes, Bill.
Our next question comes from Jordan Overturf. Your line is open.
So, Congressman Flores, the one answer that I didn't hear in that last question is whether or not you yourself would support a clean continuing resolution.
Jordan, my vote would be no at this point in time.
Okay, and my follow-up to that is, originally the discussion surrounding the shutdown was over, the provisions for the Affordable Care Act. Do you think that the shutdown has moved beyond just the ACA to more political intentions between the GOP and the Democrats?
Jordan, on our side of the aisle, it hasn't become political. It's still policy-based. But it does seem to me that there are people that are trying to capitalize on it from a political perspective. I'll give you an example. One of the persons in our conference used to serve with Harry Reid in Nevada, and he said that at this point in time, he believed, based on his experience with Harry Reid, and again, this is not me saying this is him telling, I'm just repeating what he said, is that Harry Reid doesn't care about the policy, he cares about the politics, and what Harry Reid's goal is to leave a giant smoking hole in the ground where the House currently resides. And so, whether that's true or not, I don't know. I'm just repeating what he said. So there are some people that want to make this solely on political grounds. Given the things that have been said about the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, by Harry Reid and by the President, the level of animus, I think, is exceptionally high toward the Speaker. I think that's unfortunate that they are so negative about him. Even yesterday, the President tried to rewrite history as saying that John Boehner walked away from the big deal that was being talked about in 2011. But Woodruff's book clearly talks about what happened back in 2011, and so I think the President was not justified in trying to rewrite history and do it at the expense of the Speaker. So there's some politics involved in this. I think I'd like to say that not much of it is on the Republican side. Most of it's on the Democratic side. But, on the other hand, I will tell you that the Republican Congressional Committee, every time there's a vote and Democrats vote against, WIC for children and infants and mothers, that the National Republican Congressional Committee is capitalizing on those votes the same way the Democratic Congressional Committee is trying to capitalize on the fact that the government shut down. So I think the political arms are doing their political business. We in the House are trying to stay focused on policy. We Republicans in the House are trying to stay on policy. Harry Reid does seem to be working on a different playbook, though.
And my last question for you is, how do you feel this affects, average Americans' perception of Washington politics and the harm that this could cause, because so far, everything is just kind of conjecture and there's no solid evidence of, what is that this shutdown is actually doing.
Yeah. Let me say one thing. I'm going to go back to your last question for just a second, if you will. You did ask a question if we had moved beyond the ACA. I would say that in addition to the ACA, there are new things that are on the table to be discussed about that really, I think, take priority over the ACA. Those include the drivers of our debt, the entitlements. We need to work on the economic recovery side of the equation. That will include tax reform and policy reforms on the regulatory side. So I think that, you know, the discussion with the debt ceiling and the drivers that put us into these debt ceiling situations have merged into this conversation. And in my view, they've taken precedence over the ACA. To come to your latest question, yes, I do believe that the institution has been damaged, not just the Congress, but I believe that virtually all the institutions. I mean, if you look at, I think President Obama has been damaged. His popularity is down at some of its lowest levels it's ever been. The approval rating of Congress, I think, is down around the lowest level that it's ever been. It's since I've been tracking that, it's never been very high to start with. So we didn't lose very much in terms of points, but we weren't very high to start with. But then institutions like the Park Service, I mean, the Park Service has been damaged by the behavior that they've exhibited in the shutdown. The VA was damaged by telling us that they're going to be able to operate at full speed through pretty much the end of October and then pulling the plug yesterday. You know, those types of things. Americans, I think, are rightly frustrated. They're rightly disappointed in the behavior of their federal government and pretty well anybody that's a part of it. So the only ones that haven't been damaged just yet are the courts, and I hope we can keep them from being damaged. So, yeah, Jordan, I'd say that everybody has been damaged from this.
All right. Thank you so much, Congressman.
You bet.
I'm showing no further questions.
Okay. Well, I appreciate everybody joining us today. As always, we invite you to call in at any time and have individual interviews, or if you have a specific question that comes up, and Jordan, well, I assure you, we're going to get an answer for you eventually on the number of affected people. And we will have another call as soon as we have enough cumulative news to talk about, or if something breaking comes up that we need to share with you.